Thank you for attending session 265 titled What Became of the Woolies? Mormon Fundamentalists Founding Family. Before we begin, I'd like to, we'd ask you to silence your cell phones. This session is being recorded and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. We encourage you to also purchase other Sunstone merchandise, or you can make a donation to Sunstone to help support these amazing events. Your donations keep the organization going. We need it. Please become a continual supporter of Sunstone. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within that framework. A little bit about the presentation. Excuse me. In 1886, John Taylor had a revelation to continue plural marriage. The Woolley family was in attendance and was charged to help him. They were pivotal in the founding of Short Creek and early Mormon fundamentalism, but their name is not commonly found among the principal figures today. What became of the Woolleys? Tom Bennett is a roaming mystic and full-time traveling musician. He gave two lectures at Sunstone in 2018 and performed his original music in 2017. He has been a Baptist, a Mormon fundamentalist, a Buddhist, and an occultist. His spirituality is defined by the statement, quote, "I am constantly in awe of the great mysteries which surround us," end quote. And if you would join me in welcoming Tom Bennett.
Pretty rare that I have to raise a microphone, but I just did. Thank you for joining us. As she said, my name is Tom Bennett, and this Sunstone talk is What Became of the Woolies. In this talk, I hope to articulate the events of the very confusing early post-manifesto era, especially the years 1886 to 1904. I also hope to accurately convey the stories of the characters involved. I believe all parties involved acted in their clearest conscience, whether it was to protect the church or to protect each other. Each individual described made sacrifices, some of themselves, and some sacrificed others. We are taught in the LDS Church that there was a revelation, a manifesto, and with that came the unanimous support of church membership to end the practice of plural marriage. Whether one believes it was by revelation or simply a rational act to protect the church from destruction, there was much more to these events than the church has led us to believe. It was a time of turbulence, a time of deceit. It was apostle against apostle, and Mormonism itself would be fractured forever. In this talk, I'll be quoting heavily from a few sources. One of them, I don't know who is behind the source, but the website mormonfundamentalism.com, and also D. Michael Quinn, who is sitting right back there, so that way he can correct me if I'm wrong. And there are a lot of details, so it's very easy to be wrong or misled in these circumstances. 1886 marked the beginning of what was arguably the single most definitive era of change in Mormonism. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was attempting to separate themselves from what had become the defining doctrine of the faith. Two prophets had invested themselves fully in a principle which they claim was key to the exaltation of mankind. It all began when, engaged in his work of translating the Bible, Joseph Smith had read of the wives and concubines of the great Old Testament patriarchs like Abraham and the countless other examples of polygamy, and had questioned God concerning the practice. The response was given as Doctrine and Covenants 132, and thus, though secretly at first, plural marriage began amongst the Mormons. This family structure was central to the doctrine of eternal progression. It was the marriage system of the gods, the exalting principle. However, by engaging in its practice, the Mormons would open the door to violent and bitter persecution. Joseph Smith engaged in various forms of polygamy. He practiced polygyny, which is one man with many wives. He also engaged in polyandry by marrying the wives of men who are already married. In all, it is estimated that Joseph Smith had up to 49 wives, ranging in age from the 14-year-old Helen Mar Kimball to the 78-year-old Jane Tibbetts. Though there is debate about the exact number and identity of his wives, there is no debate that Joseph Smith was a prolific polygamist by any standards. As the saints continued to grow in numbers, many of the upper leadership began to take plural wives. The principle was intended to exalt men and their families. It was taught that the spiritual growth that came from practicing plural marriage could be found in no other principle of the gospel. Many of the church members also practiced the law of adoption, sealing their families one to another as they attempted to create an unbroken chain back to Adam. There were many factors that created division amongst the Latter-day Saints and the people of the state of Missouri and America as a whole. Many of these factors, including polygamy, culminated in the murder of Joseph and Hiram Smith in Carthage, Illinois, June 27, 1844. Despite numerous schisms, the saints continued their move west, gathering under the leadership of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles leader, Brigham Young. Upon the arrival of the saints in Mexico, where they intended to build their kingdom of Deseret, Brigham Young, who by then was prophet, lifted polygamy from the shadows and extolled the virtues of the principle of plural marriage. Amongst many things he said is this definitive quote, "The only men who become gods, even the sons of God, are those that enter into polygamy." When I first investigated the LDS church in Georgia at 17 years old, it didn't take long for many to warn me of the strange practices of the so-called Mormon cult. Prominent in these warnings were claims that Mormons were polygamists. Though I came to understand that the LDS church hadn't openly engaged in or advocated the principle since 1890, plural marriage was still the first thing that came to mind when most people thought of Mormons. Upon joining the church, I began to ask various members about points of doctrine. I was surprised to see the various levels of education on just what had occurred and what was the will of God. I will always remember the cries of a 16-year-old girl in my ward as I explained to her that exaltation meant becoming a god, like him in every possible way, with boundless power, knowledge, and dominion, the way he had become God, just like the gods before him. I remember my bishop trying to explain to me how polygamy was only a matter of necessity, relegated to its time and circumstances due to the fact that too many widows were attempting to cross the plains. He seemed to know nothing of the countless quotes in the Journal of Discourses, which firmly laid out the theology behind the doctrine. I was offered meat at every table, or milk at every table, but I wanted meat. I had the pleasure of serving a mission in Utah. I was excited to serve my mission in a place where I could see the church in its strength. I knew in Utah I would be able to continue my studies. I was able to get my hands on the old literature in its original print. And we all know how important the original print is. I was able to meet many church members who had a great knowledge of the doctrines. I was able to dive in and see what had truly taken place. I came to know of multiple manifestos attempting to end polygamy, of the excommunication of general authorities for preaching and practicing the principle, and of certain key players in a complex sequence of events that are still unfolding today, 132 years later. Through it all, one name kept rising like a whisper, the name of Woolley. 1886 had found the church in a deadly position. The Republican Party had been founded to, quote, end the twin relics of barbarism, slavery, and polygamy. The Mormons had left the United States and entered into Mexico with the intention of building Deseret, a massive Zion, a nation of God. Central to this vision were the twin principles of united order and polygamy. The United States government, being well aware of this nation forming to their west, had decided to bring it to a halt. The Indians and Mexicans would not stop the manifest destiny spread of America, nor would those pesky Mormons. The Edmunds Tucker Act of 1887 was an act of Congress that focused on restricting the Mormons. It was nothing short of an anti-polygamy law. The Mormons would cease their practice or be eradicated as a church and as a people. Polygamy would be punishable by fines ranging from $500 to $800, as well as imprisonment up to 5 years. The corporation of the church was dissolved, and church properties were confiscated. Many church leaders were incarcerated. In the coming years, over 1,000 priesthood men would be jailed. The perpetual immigration fund, which the church had raised to assist European saints in their travel to Zion, was likewise disincorporated. It is interesting to note that the act was in effect until 1978, at which time it was repealed. The church hung on the edge of destruction. LDS prophet John Taylor was in hiding, as were many of the church men. The Utah War, wherein the U.S. government had sent armed troops, one-third of the American army at the time, to quell the Mormon rebellion and oust Brigham Young from power, was only 30 years past. The saints knew well that the military could return. Government agents were seeking to arrest polygamists at every turn. Many turned to a life on the underground. In the home of John Woolley in Bountiful, Utah, the prophet John Taylor hid. Correspondence was delivered by his son Lauren and a small staff of trusted priesthood men attended to the needs of the aging church leader. Taylor had endured much for Mormonism. He was with Joseph and Hiram when they were murdered. He too was wounded. He himself had 8 wives and 34 children. He was firmly committed to the principle of plural marriage and had made this fact very clear on multiple occasions. As the church and its members suffered ever increasingly, some of the membership wanted to see the church relinquish polygamy and hope for peace. Taylor was adamant that the principle would not be surrendered. See, my daughter agreed. When a document ceasing the practice was brought before Taylor, he is quoted by the Deseret News of April 23, 1885, as saying, quote, "What would be necessary to bring about the results nearest the opponents of Mormonism? Simply to renounce, abrogate, or apostatize from the new and everlasting covenant of marriage in its fullness. Were the church to do that as an entirety, God would reject the saints as a body." It was around this time where history becomes shadowed. A revelation was given. However, the debate still rages between the LDS Church and the soon-to-be-formed fundamentalist movement about exactly what that revelation was. Did John Taylor receive a revelation that secured the everlasting nature of plural marriage? Or did his successor, Wilford Woodruff, receive a revelation that suspended the practice? It has become the belief of many that a version of what would become the first manifesto ending polygamy was brought to Taylor while he was at the Woolley home. It's interesting to note it was brought to him. He never claimed to have written it. His purported reaction is poignant considering the extreme circumstances of the political climate of the Utah Territory of the day and of Taylor's personal circumstances of having long been in hiding and separated from his family and his church. It is said that upon reading the manifesto that would cease the practice of polygamy, Taylor was quoted as saying the following, "Sign that document? Never. I would rather that my right arm be severed from my body. Sanction that document? Never. I would rather that my tongue be torn from its roots." It's a shame he didn't tell us how he really felt. It could easily be debated whether or not this event transpired or whether or not Taylor responded the way it's been claimed. There were very few witnesses. However, it is absolutely clear from the report of the Deseret News of the previous year that Taylor was absolutely not ready to relinquish the principle. Back in October of 1882, John Taylor had announced a revelation from God which stated the following. "You may appoint Seymour B. Young, who was a monogamist, to fill up the vacancy in the presiding quorum of the 70s if he will conform to my law. For it is not meet that men who will not abide my law shall preside over my priesthood," end quote. Meaning that he needed to practice plural marriage or at least commit to it in the future. As federal pressure increased to arrest polygamists and suppress Mormon polygamy, John Taylor responded with even greater defiance. At a special priesthood meeting at April Conference of 1884, he asked for all monogamists serving in the ward bishoprics or stake presidencies either to make preparations to marry a plural wife or to offer their resignations from church office. And he even called out the names of monogamous stake presidents. In his last public discourse of the 1st of February, 1885, John Taylor reminded his Salt Lake City audience of the government's effort to eradicate polygamy and rhetorically asked if he should disobey God in order to support the government. His answer, no, never, no, never, no, never. President Taylor left the stand and went into a permanent exile to avoid arrest by federal officers. After 8 months in hiding, John Taylor and his first counselor, George Q. Cannon, issued a first presidency letter at the October 1885 General Conference. Quote, well-meaning friends of ours have said that our refusal to renounce the principle of celestial marriage invites destruction. They warned and implored us to yield. They reported their response. We did not reveal celestial marriage. We cannot withdraw or renounce it. D. Michael Quinn stated the following. During this 1884 to 1886 period, there were numerous appeals by prominent Mormons and friendly non-Mormons for President Taylor to issue a statement or a new revelation that would set aside the practice of plural marriage. Burdened by his own exile and the sufferings of other church members, John Taylor asked the Lord if it would not be right under the circumstances to discontinue plural marriages. In response to which, President Taylor received the word of the Lord to him, in which the Lord said that plural marriage was one of his eternal laws and that he had established it, that man had not done so, and that he would sustain and uphold his saints in carrying it out. Presently available documents of 1885 to 86 are silent about this revelation, but much later documentation and commentary identified this revelation as having been received by John Taylor on 27th of September, 1886. Counselor George Q. Cannon, who was imprisoned for practicing the principle, published two editorials in the Juvenile Instructor in which he acknowledged that some people suggested that, quote, we do not ask you to give up your belief in this doctrine. We merely ask you to suspend it for the time being, your practice of it, end quote. To which he replied that, I look upon such a suggestion as from the devil, that doing such a thing would demonstrate utter apostasy and merit the vengeance of God. If the words and actions of Taylor and Cannon were truly guided by revelation and were the will of the Lord, the church's abandonment of the principle a few short years later is something that should be questioned. Upon Taylor's death, Wilford Woodruff became president of the church. Woodruff had long felt that the church should capitulate on polygamy and submit to the terms of Washington. He understood statehood and the fate of the church hung in the balance. Due to disagreements amongst the apostles, the first presidency wasn't organized for 2 whole years after Taylor's death. Many apostles had problems with the principal supporting Cannon, who was now counselor to President Woodruff. In 1888, Woodruff presented a document to the Quorum of the Twelve asking for their signatures, confirming that they would put themselves in line with the will of the government, in essence, abandoning polygamy. Polygamy's biggest supporters, including Apostles Cannon and John W. Taylor, who was son of the previous prophet, were conveniently not present. However, none of the apostles signed the document, on the grounds that they stated that there must be a revelation first from the prophet. Plural marriages in Mexico and Utah appeared to have continued at least until 1904. Washington created a bill to stop Mormons from homesteading in Wyoming. The manifesto was soon to follow. Concerning the manifesto, George Q. Cannon wrote in his diary, this whole matter has been at President Woodruff's own insistence. He has felt strongly impelled to do what he has, and he has spoken with great plainness to the brethren in regard to the necessity of something of this kind being done. He has stated that the Lord has made it plain to him that this was his duty, and he felt perfectly clear in his mind that it was the right thing. When President Woodruff presented to the apostles in his own handwriting was a document of 510 words. This document was edited to create the published manifesto's text of 356 words. I do not personally claim to know the history of editing of revelations, but it seems like a strange practice. When at the insistence of the government, the manifesto was presented to the church at General Conference for sustaining, official accounts state that the congregation voted unanimously to sustain the manifesto, but that was not the case. William Gibson, later a representative in the Utah legislature, voted against it. He is quoted as saying, I am not ashamed of my action on the manifesto. I voted no in the conference. When George Q. Cannon announced a unanimous vote, I said, all but one, right here. We must let Babylon have her way for a while, I suppose. The majority of the congregation refused to vote at all when the manifesto was presented, with the result that Apostle Merrill observed, it was carried by a weak vote. By 1891, again at the insistence of government, the first presidency was encouraging a cessation of cohabitation, meaning that plural marriages that were already in effect should be dissolved. September 24th, 1890 became the day whereafter anyone entering into plural marriage would be excommunicated. The first presidency's official journal recorded on 21st October 1891 that President Woodruff stated that the manifesto was just as authoritative and binding as though it had been given in the form of Thus Saith the Lord. The caveat, as though, seems a bit telling as well. D. Michael Quinn outlined six ways by which plural marriage took place in the first decade post-manifesto. Amongst these ways, some men attempted to make eternal marriage without a ceremony. Mormon history shows at least one plural marriage took place this way back in 1845, years before in Nauvoo. Apostle Willard Richards recorded such an event, and this is from his journal. I took Alice Longstroth by the hand of our own free will and avowed mutual acknowledgement each other as husband and wife in a covenant not to be broken in time or eternity, for time and for all eternity, to all intents and purposes, as though the seal of the covenant had been placed upon us for time and all eternity, and called upon God and all the holy angels and Sarah to witness the same. Did the church sanction this practice? On the 5th of April, 1894, George Q. Cannon told the temple meeting of the presidency and apostles, I believe in concubinage, or some plan whereby men and women can live together under sacred ordinances and vows until they can be married. To which President Woodruff responded, if men enter into some practice of this character to raise a righteous posterity, they will be justified. Cannon advised some men to sidestep the manifesto in this way. It is quite clear that polygamy was not dead in Mormonism. As for the first attempts at a fundamentalist movement, it didn't take long. Israel A.J. Dennis taught that the LDS Church erred in entering the manifesto. He claimed that an angel gave him authority to organize the Church of the Firstborn on 7th of March, 1895, and to introduce a sealing ceremony amongst his followers. Dennis described this ceremony as a very simple ceremony by which the parties entered into a covenant one with the other. He authorized his counselor, Newark S. Dawson, to marry again, while he himself took two plural wives on the 6th of April, 1895, the anniversary of the LDS Church's founding. When Dennis was arrested and tried for adultery in 1896, he and his new wife, who was still legally married to another man, denied having ever had criminal relations, and they were acquitted by the jury. But by then, Dennis's polygamous organization had disintegrated. In 1904, the government began investigating polygamy again, and a second manifesto was issued. However, a new era was beginning. On a final note about this post-manifesto polygamy is the interesting quote from President Woodruff from a meeting of the First Presidency and the 12 on the 2nd of April, 1891, he said the following, the principle of plural marriage will yet be restored to this church, but how or when, I cannot say. It is important to note that John W. Taylor, son of the prophet, was excommunicated while serving as an apostle. His name can be found along with those of Abraham Owen Woodruff and Matthias F. Was it Crowley or Cowley? I don't know. Cowley, yeah. As apostles who married plural wives in 1900 or 1901, John W. Taylor, in his mid-40s, was the oldest of these young apostles. He had been guarding the door in 1886 at the home of John Woolley when his father, John Taylor, had allegedly received the revelation to continue the new and everlasting covenant of plural marriage. John W. Taylor had six wives and 36 children. He resigned from the Quorum of the Twelve on October 28, 1905. After disputing the doctrine with the remaining members of the quorum, he was excommunicated March 28, 1911. He remained a believer in Mormonism until his death at age 58 of stomach cancer. On August 20th, 1916, he was posthumously baptized by proxy and reinstated into the church by two stake presidents. However, a year later, the first presidency officially stated that the reinstatement was null and void. He would not be officially rebaptized and have a restoration of blessings until May 21st, 1965, at the hands of Joseph Fielding Smith. This act received the unanimous approval of the first presidency in the Quorum of the Twelve. It would also be worth noting that in 1904, Church President Joseph F. Smith testified before Congress and acknowledged that his own unwillingness to give up his plural wives had set a bad example. 3 months later, on June 6, 1904, he reiterated the church's position against plural marriage. Taking us back to 1886, in the events at the Woolley home, it is said that Taylor went to the Lord in prayer concerning the matter of the suspension of plural marriage, and the following is what transpired. Lauren C. Woolley, son of John W. Woolley, claimed the following and assigned testimony. In the latter part of September 1886, the exact day not now being known to me, President John Taylor was staying at the home of my father, John W. Woolley, in Centerville, Davis County, Utah. At the particular time herein referred to, President Taylor was in hiding. Charles H. Beryl and I were the guardsmen on watch for the protection of the president. Two were usually selected each night, and they took turns standing guard to protect the president from trespass and approaching danger. Exceptional activity was exercised by U.S. federal officers in their prosecutions of the Mormon people on account of their family relations and supposed violations of the federal laws. Soon after our watch began, Charles H. Beryl reclined on a pallet and went to sleep. President Taylor had entered the south room to retire for the night. There was no doorway entrance to the room occupied by President Taylor except the entrance from the room occupied by the guardsmen. Soon after 9 p.m., I heard the voice of another man engaged in conversation with President Taylor, and I observed that there was a brilliant light illuminating the room occupied by the president. I awakened my companion and told him what I had heard and seen, and we both remained awake, and I watched the balance of the night. The conversation carried on all night between President Taylor and the visitor had never discontinued until day began to dawn. We heard the voices and conversation, and the conference continued, and we saw the light. My father came into the room where we were on watch and was there when President Taylor came into the room that morning. As the president entered the room, he remarked, "I had a very pleasant conversation all night with the prophet Joseph." At the time President Taylor entered the room, his countenance was very bright and could be seen for several hours after. After observing that someone was in conversation with the president, I went out and examined all of the windows and found them fastened as usual. The brethren were considerably agitated at this time over the agitation about plural marriage, and some were insisting that the church issue some kind of edict to be used in Congress concerning the surrender of plural marriage, and that if some policies were not adapted to relieve the strain, that the government would force the church to surrender. Much was said in their deliberations for and against some manifesto that had been prepared, and at the meeting that afternoon, in which a number there were present, including myself, I heard President Taylor say, "Brethren, I will suffer my right hand to be cut off before I will sign that document." Lauren C. Woolley signed a document attesting to this statement on the 6th day of October, 1912. When I first came to the knowledge of these supposed events, I realized that it would be of great importance to either sustain or discredit the integrity of Lauren Woolley's claims, the weight of which is self-evident. I decided to start with a history of the Woolleys and their church experience. Lauren Woolley was the son of John Wickersham Woolley. John Woolley was born in the early days of the founding of the church in Newland, Pennsylvania in 1831. His father and mother, Edwin and Mary, joined the church after having been converted from Quakerism in 1837. Edwin went on to have seven wives. The family immigrated to Utah with the pioneers in the late 1840s. John's father, Edwin, would later become Brigham Young's business manager, as well as one of his closest friends. He was a bishop in the LDS Church from 1853 to 1881. Edwin Woolley was a top man in early Mormonism. I saw his name on historical plaques at Pipe Spring National Monument, just 7 miles into Arizona, just outside of the FLDS stronghold of Short Creek, of all places. Upon researching him, I found that Mormon polygamy had its origins in his Nauvoo home, where Joseph Smith first announced the revelation. Upon arriving in Utah, Edwin Woolley was personally called by Brigham Young to oversee ranching activities at Pipe Spring, a resting point between St. George and Kanab. Pipe Spring was essential to temple building activities in St. George. The mission at the spring provided beef, cheese, and butter to temple construction laborers. It had many thousand heads of cattle, as well as sheep, that were worth a great deal of money to the church. Pipe Spring also became a hiding place for plural wives. From the mid-1880s to the mid-1890s, 10 different plural wives were hidden at that location. Edwin D. Woolley's wife, Flora, and their children hid here across the state line at the Pipe Spring Fort. Federal agents sought plural wives as witnesses in those days. If the plural wife could not be located, it was nearly impossible for the federal deputies, referred to as DEPs by the locals, to prove cohabitation. 9 other plural wives and their children are reported to have taken refuge at Pipe Spring at various times during the raiding period, though they were never there at the same time. Their names were Josephine Snow Tanner, Georgie Snow Thatcher, sisters to Flora Snow Woolley, Linda J. or T. Maringer, sisters Ellen C. and Ann C. Chamberlain, Caroline Woolley, Emma Carolyn Siegmiller, Miss Bringhurst and Miss Sangford of Tokerville, Utah. The husbands of the 2 Tokerville wives were serving time in the penitentiary for polygamy. The Chamberlain sisters were the wives of Thomas Chamberlain, president of the United Order in Orderville. Chamberlain was one of those arrested, convicted, fined, and sentenced to prison for violation of anti-polygamy laws. Just as another matter of interest with Pipe Spring, a significant number of changes were made to the Pipe Spring fort and landscape during Flora Woolley's 5-year stay there. The fort was originally built to protect from Navajo raiders. There had been numerous settlements that were abandoned in southern Utah at the time, including Grafton and a few others. And so this fort was built at the command of Brigham Young, but it was never needed once things began to change and the region became less volatile. So Flora Woolley motivated some changes there, namely the cutting of window and door openings, the removal of the large wooden gates on the east and west of the courtyard, and all this is described if you visit Pipe Springs by Park Service historian A. Burl Clemenson's historic resource study. The changes were made in order to let in more air and light into the buildings and minimize its fortress-like effect. Flora Woolley reportedly wanting these alterations to make the place feel less like a prison. Of her move to Pike Springs, Flora once said, "I went to prison to keep my husband out." In 1959, the fort was restored to its original appearance through filling in the openings made during the Woolley period. Another change made during the period was that, at Flora Woolley's request, brick extensions were added to the upper building chimneys to improve the chimney's draw and to keep flying red ants from nesting in them. Landscape changes made during the Woolley's period included the planting of cottonwood, elm, willow, and other trees near the fort, and changes to the ponds located just south of the fort. The ponds were there prior to the arrival of the Woolley's, but during their tenancy, the ponds were enlarged, the banks built up, the stonework was constructed around them. They were used as a reservoir for water to irrigate the Woolley's orchard, garden, alfalfa, and currants. In 1890, there was about 1,400 head of cattle at Pipe Spring. During this period, cattle drank from a large watering hole in Troughs Lake, located about 200 yards west of the fort. According to Flora Woolley, 8 women gave birth to 9 children, 3 girls and 6 boys, while at Pipe Spring during the raiding years, thus earning it the popular name Woolley's Lambing Ground. Another source confirms that 8 wives gave birth at Pipe Springs, 1 bearing twins. Another humorous nickname applied to Pipe Spring during these years was the Adamless Eden, as men put themselves in legal jeopardy if caught by federal deputies while visiting their wives there. Pregnant plural wives in particular appeared to have been a threat to their husband's freedom during this period, since one couldn't explain one's delicate condition and deny a plural marriage at the same time. This might explain that unusually large number of women who gave birth at Pipe Spring over a relatively short span of time. John, Edwin's son, continued in this prominent LDS tradition, serving as a constable, justice of the peace, deputy sheriff, as well as a member of the Nauvoo Legion in Deseret. With the Legion, he held many positions of rank, including lieutenant, captain, and sergeant major. He was one of the 10 men who crossed the mountain to meet Johnson's army during the Utah War of 1857. He was ordained a priest by Brigham Young himself and was a bishop and served as high counselor in the Davis Stake. He was also ordained a patriarch and served as an ordinance worker in the Salt Lake Temple. It was his prayers that on more than one occasion opened the General Conference of the Church. When the handcart companies came in 1856, 60, and 63, Woolley was a leader amongst them. He was a lifelong friend of Joseph F. Smith and even spoke at his wife's funeral. John Woolley received his patriarchal blessing at 8 years old from Joseph Smith Sr. He was promised to be called to responsible stations, receive keys, glory, and honor, and knowledge and power. The blessing stated that he would one day be called the Lord's anointed. Fundamentalist Mormons see this as a prophecy of the role he would later play as their leader. For most of his life, John W. Woolley was a monogamist. He lived plural marriage with two wives for only 6 years between 1886 and 1892. John was sealed to Julia Cyril's Ensign March 20th, 1851, with whom he had 6 children. On October 4th, 1886, he wed Anne Everington Roberts for time only and lived the principle of plural marriage until 1892 when his first wife died. John Taylor became the prophet after the death of Brigham Young. With the stalwart background of the Woolleys, it is absolutely no surprise that he would feel safe on the underground, hiding from authorities in the John Woolley home. Anne Roberts was the widow of B.H. Roberts and bore Woolley no offspring. Anne passed away January 11th, 1910, and 2 months later, on March 23rd, John married 39-year-old Annie Fisher for time only. Despite the comparative brevity and limited plurality that John experienced in his personal polygamy, he was nevertheless a constant follower of plural marriage. Joseph F. Smith himself performed the civil ceremony wedding for John Woolley in 1910 when he married Annie Fisher. Such was his place of prominence and closeness with the upper leadership of the LDS Church. John Woolley would never deny the principle of plural marriage and was excommunicated from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on March 30th, 1914. At this point, he was viewed as a prophet amongst the fledgling fundamentalist community. At the time of his excommunication, he was a sealer in the Salt Lake Temple. John Woolley was undoubtedly devout in his devotion to the church. Along with his other callings previously mentioned, he was a Salt Lake Temple worker and sealer in 1894 and was ordained a stake patriarch in June 1913. However, he also secretly performed the sealings of Warren Longhurst and also Evan Allred in Salt Lake City, Utah, 17th November 1909, and was involved with other polygamous marriages prior to that time. Subsequently, John W. Woolley was called into a session with the Quorum of the Twelve, but disclaimed any association with those who were involved with the new plural marriages. As a close friend of John Woolley, President Smith said to him, "John, I'm very happy to know that you've not been involved in any of these so-called plural marriages." John W. Woolley hesitated a moment and then replied, "President Smith, I cannot lie to you. I am guilty." Then he confessed his wrongdoing. Upon learning of this, President Joseph F. Smith notified Francis Lyman, president of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles. A church court was held 16th of January, 1914, resulting in Woolley's disfellowship. In an attempt to regain his membership, he wrote, "Some months ago, I met Matthias F. Cowley on the street, and he asked me if I was familiar with the sealing ceremony. I told him I was. He said, 'If any good men come to you, don't turn them down.' I believed from that statement that it was still proper that plural marriages be solemnized, and that President Smith had so authorized Cowley to instruct me. Since that time, I have married wives to Nathan G. Clark, Joseph A. Silver, Reuben G. Miller, and K. Lemon, Jr. All of these men were also disciplined by the church." Should have kept his mouth shut, I guess. The Quorum of the Twelve considered Woolley's case on March 30th. Apostle James E. Talmadge recorded, "It became our painful duty to take action by which Brother John W. Woolley was excommunicated for the church, for insubordination and disobedience to the regulations of the church. It may be here stated that Brother Woolley, according to evidence in his own confession, has been instrumental in bringing about the unauthorized and sinful pretenses for plural marriage in the case of other brethren who have been of late visited with the extreme penalty of excommunication. Having already excommunicated most of the men sealed by John Woolley, a letter from the First Presidency was sent addressing the status of women who were also involved in these plural marriages. On the 11th of March, 1915, Apostle Francis M. Lyman was instructed, Joseph F. Smith recommends disfellowship or excommunication for plural wives and polygamous marriages performed by John W. Woolley. During the years following his excommunication, John Woolley desired to be reinstated, and in 1918, he asked his half-brother, George E. Woolley, to assist as an intermediary with the general authorities. John related how he felt keenly being on the outside of the church, and confessed that he had suffered very much in his feelings as a consequence of his excommunication. John W. Woolley was born December 30th, 1831, and died 13th of December, 1928. In this life, he was never readmitted to the church. I was curious as to what LDS Records had to say concerning John Woolley. The official church website under the section of history states the following. John initially traveled to the Salt Lake Valley in the Brigham Young Company of 1848. He later participated as one of the rescuers that were sent out in the winter of 1856 to assist members of the church stranded in Wyoming. John made several trips back to Missouri to assist with immigrant trains. He traveled as a captain of the guard with Joseph W. Young freight train in 1860. In 1863, he served as captain of the John W. Woolley Company. In 1864, his name is listed on the freight manifest as Bishop Woolley. The church website makes no mention of his excommunication or of his involvement in early Mormon fundamentalism. I suppose it's just another case of a faith-affirming story. John's son, Lauren Calvin Woolley, was born October 23, 1856. He was the third child of his father and his father's first wife, Julia. As a young man, he served as a bodyguard for various polygamous LDS church leaders, including John Taylor. After the events of the 1886 vision, he claimed that John Taylor set apart himself and a group of other men to ensure that plural marriage would survive. Lauren had a reputation for being a boisterous young man who frequently dominated discussions in his elders' quorum. His nickname was Noisy. Some reports claim that he claimed to have received his endowment and to have been made an apostle by Brigham Young in March of 1870 at only 13 years of age. Lauren was married on January 5, 1883 to Sarah Ann Roberts in the endowment house on Temple Square. They had 9 children. There were 7 sons, 2 daughters. He served his LDS mission to the southern states from 1887 to 1889. Upon his return, he was called to the 70th Quorum of the 70 in Centerville, Utah, and served a second 4-month-long mission to the Indian Territory. In 1922, Lauren related a spiritual experience that had allegedly taken place during his first mission, where he fell deathly ill and only recovered after the resurrected Jesus Christ, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and John Taylor intervened on his behalf. Lauren wrote his first account of the 1886 events on October 6, 1912, with the assistance of Joseph Musser. Lauren was known to frequently share his accounts for the remainder of his life. He testified that John Taylor set apart 5 men, a council of friends holding apostolic authority above the LDS Church, to ensure that no year passed without children being born in the principle of plural marriage. Lauren was excommunicated by the LDS Church in January of 1924 due to allegations he made that Church President Heber J. Grant and Apostle James E. Talmadge had taken plural wives. The Church formally denied Lauren's claims in General Conference of April 1931. Lauren Woolley's excommunication occurred on January 15, 1924. Polygamy was not the charge. He was called to a church court for teaching pernicious falsehoods. The falsehoods included the assertions that President Heber J. Grant and Talmadge had taken plural wives in the recent past. Woolley claimed to have learned of these plural marriages through his activities as an agent of the Secret Service of the United States, declaring that he was commissioned in 1890 to spy on church leaders and monitor their activities. One intriguing claim that Lauren made on several occasions involved his work as a spy. In 1874, at the age of 18, Lauren C. Woolley was set apart by Brigham Young to learn of and keep track of activities pertaining to the battle for and against the fullness of the gospel, including plural marriage. This was necessary for the protection of the saints who were trying to keep the Lord's commandments. Moroni Jessup reported that Porter Rockwell, who was also working on the underground for the kingdom of God, who died on June 9, 1878, had Lauren C. Woolley take his place. Apparently, Lauren also worked as a government agent, according to claims. Fred Cleveland recalled in 1965 that Loren Woolley explained that he was brought into the Secret Service by President Theodore Roosevelt and worked up to the position of major. Reportedly, some of his duties included spying on church leadership. He explained that he had been a government official and as such had learned many things about the Brethren, who were now so pronounced against the principle of plural marriage. It was claims such as these that eventually led to his excommunication. In a letter to the stake president dated January 18, 1924, Elder James E. Talmadge of the Quorum of the Twelve wrote, "I think you should be informed of the fact that this Loren C. Woolley has been brought to trial before the High Council of the South Davis Stake, aided by the advisory assistance of the Twelve through myself, and that on Tuesday last he was excommunicated from the church, having been found guilty of pernicious falsehoods. As testified to by witnesses, he had repeatedly stated that in his capacity as an officer of the United States Secret Service, he had trailed certain leading authorities of the church and knew of their having been guilty of violating the church rule and law against plural marriage. Last night, I had a conversation with the chief of the United States government Secret Service, and he positively denies that Loren C. Woolley was connected with that service in any capacity. And moreover, he further intimated that he may have to proceed against Woolley for making such claims. After excommunication, besides his work maintaining a farm and preaching polygamy, Loren Woolley also became involved with Bench's business ventures when they presented themselves. Woolley worked with a man named Nathaniel Baldwin at the Baldwin Radio Factory in Salt Lake. This business hired many fundamentalists in those early days. The men would meet after hours at the factory to discuss doctrine. Nathaniel Baldwin was a prominent Utah inventor during the 1920s. His successes included Baldy phones, headphones used to listen to the radio receivers of the day. Baldwin possessed a strong personality and appears to have been involved in post-manifesto polygamy, resulting in his excommunication on December of 1921. For decades prior, he had openly sympathized with several prominent so-called apostates, helping them publish their views. Baldwin's relationship with Loren C. Woolley began in August of 1921, when Baldwin attended a meeting of individuals who had been cut off for practicing plural marriage. Woolley was one of the most notable speakers. Baldwin listened to Loren speak again in September and had heard remarkable testimonies. In October, he wrote of the very interesting accounts of strange happenings that Woolley had related. He listened to Loren speak several times during the next few months and even went with him to Alpine in Salem, Utah, seeking gold and buried records. Loren was known for his bold claims. Polygamous follower Rhea Coons, I believe, reported that Loren personally told me and others that Heber J. Grant had offered to buy an island off the Pacific coast on which to transplant us polygamists in a body. Either Brother Loren told us that he replied to them, "This is the place where the issue must be fought out and this principle established." On numerous occasions, Loren Woolley shared with his audience experiences that invariably place him in the presence of resurrected and translated beings. Loren was a speaker at funerals, possibly due to his willingness to share veil-rending experiences. On several occasions, Loren related stories that involved a Lamanite prophet living in the Yucatan of Mexico. In 1931, he shared, "A Lamanite prophet is laboring among the Lamanites in Yucatan and has been laboring there about 8 months. The three Nephites are also laboring amongst the Lamanites of South and Central America and Mexico." He also taught that he had visited this Lamanite prophet. One night when Woolley was staying at the home of J. Leslie Broadbent, he reported that he had been visited by one of the three Nephite apostles and conversed with them for 1/2 to 3/4 of an hour. Woolley claimed to have been conducted by him to a temple in the Yucatan, South America, that was built shortly after the days of the Savior. It was about the size and of the same architectural design as the Salt Lake Temple. No ordinance work was being done in it, but apparently the three Lamanite chiefs have charge of it. It is immaculately kept clean. Its location is not known by the natives generally. One of the chiefs spoke of having 7 wives, and another one had 5. It took about 2 hours from the time Loren left his home until his return. He was sleeping at the home of John Y. Barlow, and during the night was seen to be missing by a member of the household who looked into the room. While Loren was there, he was introduced to a congregation of about 300 people who were awaiting instructions on the gospel. Some had become dissatisfied because of the attitude of the brethren, talking one thing for one man and another for another man. Loren claimed to have been taken and introduced to the prophet Joseph Smith under the direction of the Lord. Nephi was the name of the apostle who came for Loren. Another account gives additional details. Loren explained that he was taken to a city of white Nephites secreted in a jungle area in the Yucatan. He explained that when he was first taken there, he found them living the fullness of the gospel. They had a temple, it was industrious, delightsome, and they were righteous people. In April of 1932, Woolley claimed to have been visited by an angel of the Lord, which conducted him to the southern end of Old Mexico to a holy city of white Indians. Let's see, I'm going to kind of skim through a little bit. 2 years later, 1934, Lawrence C. Woolley passed away. Thereby making the transfer of seniority to this, some people claim he transferred his authority to the Yucatan prophet. Not all listeners agreed with the recollection of Woolley's claims concerning his visits to the Yucatan, which, it's a lot to believe. Let's see. Lawrence C. Woolley. Let's see. I'm trying to find the part about his marriage. Concerning Lauren's polygamy, Lauren took Gulda, I don't know how to pronounce this last name, Metch, maybe? Kamich, there you go. Has a plural wife on November 25th, 1932. It appears that no children came from this union. Some suppose that Lauren possibly married four of his first cousins, but there is no definite proof to substantiate this. It is important to note that despite Lauren's claims of the events of 1886, John W. Taylor turned in a revelation which he claimed was written by his father's hand. So regardless of Lauren's claims, John W. Taylor turned in his own revelation. To wrap it up, in searching for the Woolleys, I was very curious because when you visit Short Creek and other fundamentalist communities, you'll see a lot of common names. Barlow, Broadbent, Jessup, Musser, Jeff, Steeds, Kingston. There's a lot of names that are very prominent. But Woolleys is not one that you encounter very much. I asked around and eventually found some descendants of the Woolleys from the female line, and many of them live in the Centennial Park community across the street from where the FLDS live in Colorado City. I met with one gentleman who I spoke with, and though he was approaching senior years, he possessed a most remarkable memory, which he demonstrated to me in many ways. He claimed that was a Woolley trait, having a remarkable memory. This older gentleman possessed a great sense of vitality, which he assured me was a blessing of his practicing of plural marriage. The impact of the Woolley family will long be felt amongst the descendants of the Latter-day Saints. I found that many of the Woolleys in the generation after Lawrence C. Woolley returned to the LDS Church. However, many years later, a different group of the Woolley family was converted to fundamentalist thinking by the writings of the Truth magazine. So many of them found their way back into fundamentalism. Amongst the LDS, Spencer W. Kimball is a descendant. Spencer Woolley Kimball, yep. And it is likely through this line that the Woolleys have active LDS church membership to this day. It is unknown to me if the fundamentalist Woolleys had their blessings reinstated posthumously as John W. Taylor did. The Woolley family has left a legacy that will long motivate theological minds and provide an interesting story for generations to come. This concludes my remarks. I only have a few minutes left, but if there are any questions I can answer, I'd be glad to do it. Thank you.
If you would like to ask questions, please come to the mic and line up. Let me move it so that it's not in front of a table. And we only have about 7 minutes.
I was just going to say the MormonFundamentalism.com is Brian C. Hales, I believe.
Oh, okay.
And I was curious about the location of the Revelation 1886 revelation.
Where it happened?
Yeah, well, and if that house still exists, and is it a site of pilgrimage or of veneration?
It was at the Woolley home in, what was that, Centerville, Utah? I looked into that a little bit. I don't believe the home exists anymore, but I know that a house involved with those events is at This Is the Place Park, but I don't know whose house that is.
There's a house
It is that house? Oh, that's interesting. There you go. Oh. I know it was added to and modified over the years. I haven't been there personally, but probably worth seeing. Any other questions? Comments? Guess that's it.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thank you, everyone, for attending.